Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record Program 1009. The deep politics of Habsburg Redux and the Russiagate PSYOP. This is being recorded on May 29th of the year 2018. In this program, we are going to discuss some dealings between U.S. intelligence and elements of the Third Reich, and in particular, people belonging to and or associated with the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs are the royal family of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which ruled for 600 years, and they are still very much in the power political mix. In For the Record shows 1007 and 1008, we took a look at the Habsburgs, the maneuvering around Ukraine. We took a look at evidentiary tributaries running back in the direction of 9/11, and things having to do with Liechtenstein. Liechtenstein is a tiny little country with a population barely larger than that of the student body of Ohio State University. 32,000 at Ohio State last I checked, was about 30,000. And it also is a monarchy for a time. In 2001, Liechtenstein became the only absolute monarchy in Europe, with Prince Hans Adam II having been basically elevated to the position of absolute monarch of that tiny country, courtesy of the Progressive Citizens Party and Norbert Seeger. That last name is S-E-E-G-E-R. Seeger is associated with or works with the Crown Alpha subsidiary. That is a subsidiary of the Alpha Bank, which figures in our analysis in many ways. The House of Liechtenstein, in the person for our purposes in 1007 and 1008, is a subsidiary of the House of Habsburg. Liechtenstein was bought from the Austro-Hungarian Empire about 300 years ago, and the royal family of Liechtenstein maintains very close relationships with the House of Habsburg. In this program, we are going to take a look at the deep politics of the very tangled, complex, and multi-layered concatenation that we have been looking at. It is sort of funny to me, not ha-ha funny, but oh my God funny, to contemplate how dumbed down our society is, and then to reflect on the things that I have been speaking about. Liechtenstein, the average American at this point couldn't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips. You talk to an American about Liechtenstein and go, "What? Liechtenstein? What is that? Dave Emery's talking all them funny words. Liechtenstein, what is that? That's that kind of cheese, right? Smells real bad." No, actually, it is a tiny European country that is a lean, mean, money laundering machine, vertically integrated, and not incidentally the home to the Bank Alpaca, which figures prominently in the September 11th investigation. What we are going to look at in this program is a relationship between powerful Wall Street lawyers and American politicians and the Habsburgs and a prospective revitalized Danubian Confederation, read mini Austro-Hungarian Empire, as an anti-Soviet / anti-communist bulwark in Europe. This relationship gained gravitas during the Second World War after the Battle of Stalingrad sealed the Third Reich's fate. The SS, and specifically the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, and one of its top officers, a guy named Walter, W-A-L-T-E-R, Schellenberg, S-C-H-E-L-L-E-N-B-E-R-G, who was in charge of Amt 6 for the Secretites. Binz was the SS intelligence service. It was basically in charge of overseas intelligence for the SS. Schellenberg was also a member of the board of directors of International Telephone and Telegraph, one of whose subsidiaries, the Lorenz Company, built the Focke-Wulf aircraft for the Third Reich. He also, Schellenberg, that is, also became a key Galen operative in the post-World War II period. When the fate, the military fate of Germany was sealed by the Battle of Stalingrad, Prince von Hohenlohe, acting as an intermediary for Walter Schellenberg, began speaking with various Western intel figures, including William Donovan, Alan Dulles, and Sir Stuart Menzies, the head of MI6, that is the British Overseas Intelligence Service. Menzies, by the way, was the role model for M in the James Bond novels of Ian Fleming. Von Hohenlohe had married into the Habsburg family, and he resided in at this point in time and traveled on the passport of Liechtenstein, which again, the House of Liechtenstein basically is an annex or a subsidiary element of the House of Habsburg. What Hohenlohe and behind him Schellenberg and the SD were doing was working out what in AFA 37 we examined as the Christian West concept. The idea was to meld a Hitlerless Reich and a Himmlerless Reich onto a Western alliance in Europe as an anti-Soviet, anti-communist engine. One of the people who was also involved in these negotiations, in addition to Alan Dulles and William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II Intelligence Service, was Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, head of the Abwehr, German military intelligence. We're going to plunge right in, and time permitting, I'm going to review the Habsburg links to what is going on in Ukraine, the Habsburg links to European integration. We went into this in For the Record 1008. And what we are going to be seeing here is the deep politics and the historical development of the relationships that have manifested in Ukraine, where Paul Manafort, who is quite obviously a U.S. intelligence officer and formerly the campaign manager for Donald Trump, was not working for the Russians, but rather was working to tease Ukraine out of the Russian orbit and into the Western orbit. He was unsuccessful, and when that happened, he may very well have played a role, and certainly the OUNB successor organizations, with organizations like Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, and various people like Andrei Artemenko, Andrei Perebwy, and others, basically became Plan B or Plan OUNB, and the Euromaidan coup took place as a result. We're going to be relying for most of the discussion in this program on a very important book called The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch, published in hardcover by Charles Scribner's and Sons, and then later published in softcover. The book didn't get much coverage and raised a lot of hackles, and we're going to see the reasons for that. In past programs, we have talked about how Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles worked for the very powerful Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Frank Wisner, who became head of the OPC and was in many ways Dulles' number two man at CIA, Wisner had worked for Kutcher, Ledyard, and Milburn, another very important Wall Street law firm that was at one time the general counsel for the Dow Jones Corporation, which used to own the New York Stock Exchange. It is now privately owned, I suspect. It's certainly privately owned by some guy out of Atlanta, whom I suspect is a cat's paw for the Borman Group. William Donovan, as well, had a background in Wall Street law. And in the opening of The Old Boys, Burton Hirsch ruminates about how Wall Street lawyers were ideally suited to become heads of a civilian intelligence service. And I think we can see in the role of Paul Manafort or Lee Harvey Manafort, who, like Lee Harvey Oswald and Edwin Wilson before him, was sent to do something by probably CIA, maybe State Department intel, and was then left out in the cold. In The Old Boys, Burton Hirsch discusses how Wall Street lawyers like Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner were ideally suited to head up intelligence services. Donovan's profession was relevant, and it is equally no accident that all three load-bearing professionals throughout this work, Bill Donovan, Alan Dulles, and Frank Wisner, achieved status in America by way of important Wall Street partnerships. In many ways, a trusted corporate attorney accomplishes substantially for his clients what today's one-stop national intelligence factory goes after for its patron. He puts the deals together, he damps down crises and flaps, he keeps the process as confidential as possible. He finds out everything he can and resorts to every means imaginable to shape the outcome. He proceeds by the case system and preferably one emergency at a time. Furthermore, an intelligence service concocted by lawyers, men accustomed not merely to spotting the problems, but also to defining them to their clients and recommending appropriate action, is far more likely than a traditional military intelligence staff to reach in and condition policy. Attorneys have a seductive way of subordinating their clients, of insinuating their leisure domain until they become the strategic entanglements. And thus it develops that in many strategic entanglements, the lawyers have at least as much control over the outcome as any elected official. Later, Burton Hirsch analyzes some of the findings of the Church Committee in the 70s, which examined CIA misdeeds or gaffes, did so in a very attenuated fashion, and assesses this in the same context, that of Wall Street law. Policy direction, unquote, the Church Committee experts concluded, took the form of condoning and fostering activity without providing scrutiny and control, unquote, or, again, quoting, establishing firm guidelines for approval. Wisner built his covert action factory around procedures analogous to those which prevailed in the important law firms, where high-powered business getters easily cornered the lucrative partnerships, brought in preferred clients, raked off contingency fees, and skirted the more controversial details when delineating touchy cases in front of staid senior figures. The key was breadth, internal velocity, and compounding billable hours. The impact on society itself, like the ethics of the client, appeared beside the point. And also in The Old Boys, the author discusses one of the early missions of William Wild Bill Donovan, and that was traveling to Europe and assessing things as something of an intelligence point man for J.P. Morgan and Sons, who, like the rest of American investment bankers, was preparing a $2 billion investment package for Europe. We talked about that in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Recap that in For the Record 511. And there is good discussion of that in the introduction to the Books for Download section of the SpitfireList.com website.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I would note that in the early 1920s, $2 billion was a whole lot more money than it is today. Of William Donovan's role as an intelligence point man for the Morgan Investments and for other American investment bankers getting ready to invest in Europe under the Dawes and Young plan. Hirsch writes, barely returned from Siberia. Ruth Donovan, that was where Donovan was monitoring the anti-Soviet expeditionary force that the U.S., Britain, France, and Japan had sent to try to crush the Bolshevik regime. Barely returned from Siberia, Ruth Donovan was disheartened in February of 1920 to hear that her husband had picked up yet another excuse to travel. He was quietly approached by representatives of the preeminent law firm of J.P. Morgan and Sons. The country's most influential investment bankers were reconnoitering the market for a $2 billion package of securities around Central and Eastern Europe. Skipping down. The junket in and of itself amounted to a kind of one-man intelligence suite, an effort to assimilate, interpret, and ultimately project as a finished report information on which both judgments and predictions might reasonably be based. Donovan's notes would amount to a rudimentary version of what later espionage services would title a national intelligence estimate. And one of the things that Donovan did in a couple of years later in another of his off-the-books intelligence ventures, he had lunch in 1923 with a young Adolf Hitler. This was obviously before November 9th when the beer hall putsch took place, because Hitler was then in Landsberg prison after that. One wonders what the eventual head of the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency, and the forerunner of the CIA, was doing in early in 1923, having lunch with the up-and-coming Adolf Hitler. Burton Hirsch writes about that. These early fact-finding missions had left the agile, energetic attorney Donovan eager to track events. Months at a time, and normally without Ruth, would find him popping up abroad, frequently near some political trouble spot. As early as 1923, he materialized in Berchtesgaden to share a beer in the Gastzimmer of a modest pension with Adolf Hitler. The clammy young rabble-rouser Hitler ranted to the sympathetic attorney. Again, notice, the clammy young rabble-rouser Hitler ranted to the sympathetic attorney that he, unlike the family dog, could not be beaten by his miserable father until he wet the carpet. And again, I think this, we'll see later how incredibly sensitive Donovan's activities were, in even many years after the war. But put this one away for future pondering. What we're going to look at next is the formation of the U.S. Intelligence Habsburg Alliance as part of an the forging of an anti-communist slash anti-bulwark entity in Europe, this under President Wilson. Again, turning to the old boys, again, this is at the very end of the immediate post World War I period. Eventually, the Habsburgs would desert Germany in return for an American commitment, subsidized by the United States, which brought over to Europe the president's close advisor, Professor George D. Herron, to impart Wilson's vital imprimatur. This updated Habsburg sovereignty must commit in advance to eradicating the Bolsheviks, a revitalized Austro-Hungarian buffer zone to fend off Soviet penetration of the Balkans, turned into a lifelong chimera or chimera for Dulles, and spurred his devotion over the many years to some manner of, quote, Danubian federation, unquote. The Danube flowed through much of the Austro-Hungarian Empire through Vienna, and it is that Danubian confederation that ultimately became the Habsburg role in the alliance that was to become part of the Christian West entity that we spoke about in AFA 37, and that we can see, I think, manifesting in the maneuvering around Ukraine and the activities of Lee Harvey Manafort. In AFA 37, in the description for that, I wrote about the Christian West and defined it as follows. From the description for AFA 37. When it became clear that the armies of the Third Reich were going to be defeated, it opened secret negotiations with representatives of the Western Allies. Representatives on both sides belonged to the transatlantic financial and industrial fraternity that had actively supported fascism. The thrust of these negotiations was the establishment of the Christian West. Viewed by the Nazis as a vehicle for surviving military defeat, the Christian West involved a Hitlerless Reich joining with the U.S., Britain, France, and other European nations in a transatlantic, pan-European, anti-Soviet alliance. In fact, the Christian West became a reality only after the cessation of hostilities. The denazification of Germany was aborted, although a few of the more obvious and obnoxious elements of Nazism were removed. Nazis were returned to power at virtually every level and in almost every capacity in the Federal Republic of Germany. And I would add that people like the Dulles brothers, who have worked so intimately with companies like IG Farben and eventually the Bormann Group, well, they faced no retribution whatsoever in the U.S. Now, about the integration or the further development of the U.S. intelligence and Habsburg alliance and its integration with a Christian West, Hitlerless Third Reich as part of what Dulles referred to as a Danubian federation, an anti-Soviet bulwark across Central and Eastern Europe, and the negotiations that were to take place between Prince Max Eugen Egon von Hohenlohe-Langenburg, that's Hohenlohe-Langenburg, Langenburg. Prince Hohenlohe had married into the Habsburg family and was residing and conducted many of these negotiations in Liechtenstein. He traveled on a Liechtenstein passport, and as we looked at in, for the record, 1007 and 1008, the House of Liechtenstein is something of an annex of the Habsburgs. Now, some of the names here, again, Alan Dulles was deeply involved with Prince von Hohenlohe. Von Hohenlohe was operating at the behest of Walter Schellenberg, a very important historical figure, Walter, W-A-L-T-E-R, Schellenberg, S-C-H-E-L-L-E-N-B-E-R-G. He was in charge of Amt 6 for the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, the SS Intelligence Service, that was in charge of Amt 6, overseas intelligence for the SS. He, in turn, Schellenberg, was a director of IT&T, as I mentioned. Eventually, he went on to become a key official of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. Some of the names of the people who Schellenberg was and von Hohenlohe were working with. First of all, they conducted these Christian West negotiations with Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, who relatively early on in World War II foresaw Germany's defeat and was attempting to forge an alliance with some of the Allies, Britain in particular. Admiral Wilhelm Canaris figures into this negotiation very importantly. Alan Dulles, we have already mentioned, he was in charge of the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency, and the forerunner of the CIA. That was headed up by William Wild Bill Donovan, about whom we've already spoken. Donovan was deeply involved with the Christian-West negotiations. Also, Stuart Menzies, the head of Britain's MI6, and that is British Foreign Intelligence, and the role model for M in the James Bond novels, Ian Fleming having worked for MI6. Those are some of the key names here, and we're going to take a look now at this negotiation, which took place behind the scenes between Habsburg in-law, basically a guy who married into the Habsburgs, Max Egon von Hohenlohe, acting as a proxy for Amt 6 of the SD, Walter Schellenberg, and also working in conjunction with Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. On the Allied side, or perhaps, quote, Allied side, Alan Dulles, William Wild Bill Donovan, and Sir Stuart Menzies. And as we are going to see, one of the things that Alan Dulles was looking to do here was to recast and to firm up the alliance between Western Intel and the Habsburgs as part of an anti-communist, anti-Soviet bulwark that was also, and this is very important, I believe, to serve as a bulwark against Pan-Slavism. The Habsburgs were deeply involved in the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, and they are deeply involved, as we saw in For the Record 1008, in Ukraine. Obviously, Russia is no longer communist, but I believe the attempt to prevent Pan-Slavism, and beyond that, to ultimately colonize, even break up Russia, in particular, use Islamists to affect the secession, of the oil-producing Caucasus, I think is very much on the Western agenda. So again, we are going to launch into the Christian-West negotiations conducted by Habsburg in-law Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe, operating out of and traveling on the passport of Liechtenstein, working as a proxy for Walter Schellenberg, and working with Alan Dulles, William Donovan, Stuart Menzies, and others. Turning once again to the old boys, the America and the Wheat, and the origins of the CIA. As early as the winter of 1942, Walter Schellenberg hinted to the uneasy Heinrich Himmler that he now intended to launch discreet soundings. These ranged from Abram, Stevens, Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, and Stockholm, to Theodore Morday, M-O-R-D-E, a Reader's Digest correspondent in Ankara. Inevitably, Schellenberg discovered a go-between with lines to Alan Dulles, and early in 1943, a series of discussions ensued. Thus opened the contested exchanges between Mr. Bull, unquote, Dulles, and Mr. Pauls, P-A-U-L-S, Prince Egon zu Hohenlohe Langenberg. Max Hohenlohe had long been an international set acquaintance of Dulles, a bustling, polished socialite from the Sudetenland whose status as a minor royal drew customers for munitions from the Skoda Works, at S-K-O-D-A, a concession Schellenberg helped him snag. By the way, Skoda, a major Czech arms manufacturer with an interlocking directorate, at least at that time, with Schneider Creusot, a major French munitions manufacturer.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal. specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing, Hohenlohe already bestowed over vast landed properties in Spain after marrying into the Habsburg family. He was currently hedging his political future by traveling on a Liechtenstein passport. This last sentence again because it's critical. Hohenlohe already bestowed over vast landed properties in Spain after marrying into the Habsburg family. He was currently hedging his political future by traveling on a Liechtenstein passport. A familiar of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, Prince Hohenlohe caught Schellenberg's attention early in 1942 by sending the rising SD official his own jaundiced appraisal of prospects in Europe. With the all-seeing SD commander Reinhard Heydrich assassinated at the end of May of 1942, possibilities had obviously widened for the opportunistic Schellenberg. Barely 30 years old, scarcely beyond his baby fat, the Amt Six chieftain resembled an SS doll decked out in death's head campaign hat and tailored parade uniform. With Schellenberg's cautious sponsorship, Max von Hohenlohe trotted out a line of provisional peace proposals, first with the British ambassador Sir Samuel Hoare, always a soft touch, that's by the way, H-O-A-R-E, and the sympathetic American counselor of embassy, William Walton Butterworth, an intimate of George Kennan's since their days at Princeton University. With Vatican sympathizers, with Fritz Klein, a friend of both the Dulles brothers, and evidently at the recommendation of American negotiators in Lisbon, where Kennan and Colonel Solberg were stationed, with Alan Dulles himself for the middle of February of 1943. Exactly what was agreed upon has become a matter of dispute, largely because the SS summations of the exchanges appear to have passed through Russian hands on their way to the archives, after which the USSR news services waited until 1948 and the upheavals of the Cold War to put them out as dispatches. Nevertheless, much of their thrust is borne out by related RSHA paperwork, private journals, and intelligence files from a variety of sources. RSHA, by the way, the Reich Sicherheitshauptamt, the High Bureau of Reich Security that was in charge of the SS and the SD. That was the bureau that included the SS and the SD. Also the criminal Polizei as well. And next we're going to go into Alan Dulles' views of what he felt should be done. It is really interesting to me that he felt that Jewish malcontents and, quote, prejudiced Jews should be resettled, perhaps in Africa. I don't think it takes too much extrapolation to see the present-day Israel as perhaps a repository for some of the people that Dulles wanted to see kicked out of the country, as Donald Trump might put it. I will also note the Fugu Plan. That was a Japanese contingency plan to set up a Jewish emigre state as a buffer zone between their colony in Manchukuo, or the former Chinese province of Manchuria, and the former Soviet Union. Perhaps we'll go into that in a future date. Now, this is what Alan Dulles was working on with Prince von Hohenlohe, again, acting as a proxy for Walter Schellenberg, and also working with Admiral Canaris and William Donovan. What seemed most scandalous at the time was Dulles' reported pique with, quote, outdated politicians, emigres, and prejudiced Jews, unquote. The hope in America was that these malcontents could be resettled, perhaps, in Africa, unquote. As one in close touch with Vatican circles, Dulles maintained, he strongly urged the German bishops, unquote, to plead Germany's cause in America, keeping in mind that, quote, it had been the American Catholics who forced the Jewish American papers to stop their baiting of Franco Spain. This has the look of crumbs spread upon the water. Pronouncements alternated with rich meals in a Liechtenstein chateau. Prince von Hohenlohe, bit by bit, exposed his quasi-official status as a spokesman for SS elements within the German government, who now looked beyond the wild men, unquote, in control. What casts a longer shadow is the outline of Allen's geopolitical ideas. A longer shadow, indeed, because I think we can see the evolved geopolitical ideas put forth by Alan Dulles here in the admittedly very complex concatenation that we have been looking at, in particular in For the Records 1007 and 1008. Also, For the Record 967, 981, 982, and 993 will fill out some of the details in this concatenation. Again, from Burton Hirsch's The Old Boys, The American Elite, and the Origins of the CIA. What casts a longer shadow is the outline of Allen's geopolitical ideas. The piece he has in mind, Dulles indicates, must avoid the excesses of Versailles and permit the expanded German polity to survive, Austria included, and possibly at least a section of Czechoslovakia, while excluding all thought of, quote, victors and vanquished as a factor of order and progress, unquote. Once more, because what he really is doing, this is Christian West, and I think it doesn't require much of a leap of imagination at all to see a version of this in the European integration, unquote, which both Lee Harvey Manafort and the Habsburgs and other elements of Western intel have been working at in Ukraine, and indeed the EU itself. Again, from Burton Hirsch's text, what casts a longer shadow is the outline of Allen's geopolitical ideas. The peace he has in mind, Dulles indicates, must avoid the excesses of Versailles and permit the expanded German polity to survive, Austria included, and possibly at least a section of Czechoslovakia, while excluding all thought of, quote, victors and vanquished as a factor of order and progress, unquote. Within this decentralized nation, the importance of Prussia must be reduced to ward off for the future. Dulles is quoted directly here. The, quote, inwardly unbalanced, inferiority complex-ridden Prussian militarism, unquote. And note the following. The resultant Greater Germany, unquote, would backstop the formation of a cordon sanitaire against Bolshevism and Pan-Slavism through the eastward enlargement of Poland and the preservation of a strong Hungary. This federal Greater Germany, similar to the United States, with an associated Danube Confederation, would be the best guarantee of order and progress in Central and Eastern Europe. Indeed, the EU is talking about becoming a more federalized entity, and the EU is, of course, dominated by Germany. And skipping down, an Abwehr officer F. Eustace, J-U-S-T-U-S, von Einem, V-O-N, capital E-I-M-E-M, later claimed to have sat in on a carefully prepared meeting at Santander in Spain in the summer of 1943, during which both Stuart Menzies of MI6 and William Donovan of the OSS agreed to Christian Western terms as recapitulated by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris of the Abwehr personally. If this exchange occurred, Donovan kept it quiet. That, by the way, is from a biography of Canaris by Heinz Hühne, a respected German author. And indeed, if it occurred, and I suspect it did, Donovan would have kept it quiet. And later on, we're going to see just how sensitive some of these things were, many, many years after the official conclusion of World War II. Such exploratory talks pointed well beyond the uproar of the moment. Quote, "I have known Max Hohenlohe since the days of the war," unquote, Dulles assured a lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell in 1965, apropos a legal favor requested by the aging prince. Quote, "When he worked with me on some rather difficult and delicate problems," unquote. The exchanges in Liechtenstein amounted to a reconnoitering. Indeed, it is beyond my abilities and the scope of this program. We have roughly 20 minutes left to recap everything we looked at in For the Record 1007 and 1008. In the written description for this program and for the Record 1008, which is already available, the written description for this program will be available presently. There is a good summation and digestion of the key points of discussion in 1007 and 1008 with regard to things like the Bank Altaqua, Liechtenstein, the House of Habsburg, Ukraine, and Lee Harvey Manafort, and things of that kind. I am going to briefly recap the role of the Habsburgs. And remember that Lee Harvey Manafort, again, certainly a U.S. intelligence officer, whether State Department intel or CIA, what he was working on was to try and wean Ukraine, the western part of which Galicia had been a key part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, to wean it away from Russia, out of the Russian orbit, and into the West. He was doing this as an advisor to then-Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, and doing so in cooperation with a group of European politicians who were dubbed the Habsburg Group. One of the people who was working with Manafort and the Habsburg Group was a Dutch attorney named Alex van der Zwaan, whose father-in-law had been one of the founders of the Alpha Bank. And that his father-in-law had been born in Kiev in western Ukraine, or what used to be Galicia, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, recapping, and there are links in the written description for the Record 1009, which will become available presently. And these are also in the description for the Record 1008, which is available. Summing up the Habsburg links to the Ukrainian negotiations and to power politics in Ukraine, bearing in mind the Dulles von Hohenlohe Danubian Confederation and the alliance between Western Intel and the Habsburgs dating back to the immediate post-World War I period and the administration of the Princeton-educated Woodrow Wilson, and using the Habsburgs as an anti-Russian or anti-Soviet, anti-communist alliance, and as a bulwark against Pan-Slavism. I think it is in that latter context and in an anti-Russian context, and ultimately I think the goal of elements, corporate elements within the West, to break up Russia and in particular use Islamists to gain control of the oil-producing Caucasus part of Russia, and that the Habsburg alliance dating back to the immediate World War I period and manifesting in the Christian West negotiations between Dulles, Donovan, Canaris et al. And Prince Max Eggen von Hohenlohe of the Habsburgs, operating as a proxy for Walter Schellenberg and the SS. from, for the record, 1008, about the Habsburgs and their involvement with European integration, with the pan-European movement. Again, this fits into the Allen Dulles concept and the concept that dates back to the Wilson Agreement with the Habsburgs at the end of World War I. And the links for the articles are in this description.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
The most striking example of the trend is the appointment this week of Georg von Habsburg, the 32-year-old grandson of Emperor Karl I, to the position of Hungary's ambassador for European integration. In neighboring Austria, the traditional heart of Habsburg power, Georg's brother Karl, 35, was recently elected to represent the country in the European Parliament. In addition to this, he serves as the president of the Austrian branch of the Pan-European Movement. And a Habsburg princess. The heirs to the Habsburg Empire's emperors, helped speed the downfall of the Soviet Empire, particularly by arranging the cross border exodus from Hungary to Austria in the summer of 1989 that punched the first big hole in the Iron Curtain. And again, in For the Record 1008, we talked about a member of the Habsburg family, a Habsburg princess, who was appointed as Georgia's ambassador to Germany and who was networking with Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, who for a time became the governor of the Ukrainian province of Odessa. Note again the role of the Habsburgs in the closing phase of the Cold War. The heirs to the Habsburg emperors helped speed the downfall of the Soviet Empire, particularly by arranging the cross-border exodus from Hungary to Austria in the summer of 1989 that punched the first big hole in the Iron Curtain, unquote. And note again, Prince Wilhelm von Habsburg, who was very active in Ukraine. He was a military officer by training, fought with the Ukrainian army against Russia in the following World War I, and ultimately was working against the Soviets, who were able to purloin him, and was imprisoned in Kiev, which at that time was still part of the Soviet Union. A military officer by training, Wilhelm von Habsburg supported Ukraine's independence struggle during World War I. He fought with Ukrainian troops against the Russians and had schemed and cajoled a myriad of politicians to support his monarchical aspirations. Almost until his death at the hands of the Soviets in 1948, he was snatched off the streets of Vienna and transported to a prison in Kiev for working as an agent against the Soviet Union. Wilhelm believed that this slice of the family's empire could be his. Again, look at this in the context of the Dulles von Hohenlohe-Schellenberg Donovan-Canales negotiations that we have been looking at. And Karl von Habsburg, very active in Western Ukraine. He had a radio station that was broadcasting, quote, European, from a European perspective. Since the 20th of January, this is 2015, a truly European radio station, note this again, since the 20th of January, this of 2015, after the Maidan coup, a truly European radio station is broadcasting in Ukraine. Its main sponsor, Karl Habsburg Lothringen, told Euractiv in an exclusive interview. Karl Habsburg Lothringen is an Austrian politician and head of the House of Habsburg. Since 1986, he has served as president of the Austrian branch of the Pan-European Union, unquote. Ultimately, as we have seen, the negotiations with the Habsburg group and Lee Harvey Manafort were unsuccessful, and the agreement between the Yanukovych government and the EU, the associational agreement, was not only rejected by people in Ukraine because it was a manifestation of the austerity that has actually threatened EU cohesion, but Putin put the kibosh on that, and that was the end of that. Then Plan B was put into effect to get Ukraine into the Western orbit. That was the Maidan coup, basically staffed by, in a military and political sense, the OUNB's successor organizations like Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, and people like Andrei Parubyi and others about whom we have spoken so often. As we looked at in the conclusion to For the Record 1008, this too is a manifestation, a part of the Christian West anti-communist, now anti-Russian alliance that saw the fascist powers of Europe, including the OUNB, Third Reich ally, those post-World War II elements allied with the Habsburgs. Otto von Habsburg, who was part of the Free Rudolf Hess Committee, his idea of freedom, formed something called the European Freedom Council in 1967 with Jaroslav Stetsko. Jaroslav Stetsko was the World War II, was head of the World War II Ukrainian satellite state that was allied with Nazi Germany and that implemented Nazi ethnic cleansing in Ukraine. Stetsko was also head of the OUNB and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The latter was a renaming of the Committee of Subjugated Nations, a consortium of Eastern European fascist groups like the Romanian Iron Guard, the Bulgarian National Front, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Croatian Ustashi, and the OUNB, the Hungarian Arrow Cross and the OUNB, the most important of those organizations. That was the ABN. Note that the personal secretary of Jaroslav Stetsko in the 1980s was a guy named Roman Zvorich. He became the Ukrainian Minister of Justice, the equivalent of our Attorney General, under Viktor Yushchenko, the beneficiary of the Orange Revolution, who married Ekaterina Shumachenko, a key OUNB/UCCA operative, who was deputy head of presidential liaison under Ronald Reagan. Zvorich also was the Minister of Justice under both Timoshenko governments, is a key advisor to Petro Poroshenko, and is the spokesperson for the Nazi Azov Battalion. Of the Otto von Habsburg, Yaroslav Stetsko Alliance, we read, again, this is discussed at greater length in For the Record 1008 and the written description. The Habsburg monarchy helped guide the leadership in their former possessions. The European Freedom Council was formed by Otto von Habsburg and Yaroslav Stetsko at a conference in Munich on June 30th through July 2nd of 1967 as a coordinating body for the organization's fighting communism in Europe. Emperor His Royal Highness Otto von Habsburg was honorary chairman of the European Freedom Council based in Europe during the 1980s and allied to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Well, I'm going to conclude the main body of the program with is a reading from the introduction, the preface, to a biography of William Wild Bill Donovan, again, the Wall Street lawyer who lunched with Hitler in 1923, who was involved with the negotiations with Canaros, Prince von Hohenlohe et al., and who was operating on behalf of the Morgans and other American investment bankers in the early 1920s. He himself, Donovan, that is, was a prominent Wall Street lawyer. In the introduction to The Last Hero by Anthony K. Brown, that was a biography of William Donovan, copyright 1982 and published by New York Times Books, there is discussion of the microfilming of the OSS files by William Donovan and a close aide, and what happened to four authors who tried to write the history of the OSS. From The Last Hero by Anthony K. Brown, we read, in what was his last act of World War II, Major General William J. Donovan, director of the Office of Strategic Services, the first American Secret Intelligence and Special Operations Service, and the organization from which sprang the CIA, spent several nights at OSS headquarters in Washington, D.C., with his executive officer, Lieutenant Edwin J. Putzel, Jr., P-U-T-Z-E-L-L, microfilming the director's files. Doing the work themselves because of the political sensitivity of the documentation, Donovan and Putzel produced two copies. Donovan took possession of one and Putzel the other. The purpose of this large operation was to provide the basis of history of Donovan's incumbency when that became politically possible. Now note what happened. Several starts were made on the work. Professor Conyers Reed, C-O-N-Y-E-R-S, last name capital R-E-A-D, the Harvard historian, produced many draft chapters before Donovan himself asked him to stop the work because he felt that the director's papers were still too sensitive. Reed did not resume his work, for death intervened. One of Donovan's wartime majors, Corey C-O-R-E-Y Ford, F-O-R-D, then began work on the project in the mid-1950s, producing a draft manuscript of what was really a biographical history of Donovan and the OSS. But again, death intervened before Ford could complete his volume. After Donovan's death in 1959, the project was taken over by Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y, Shepardson, S-H-E-P-A-R-D-S-O-N, Donovan's chief of secret intelligence during World War II. For the third time, the author died before completing the work. Then came the fourth attempt, this time by Cornelius Ryan, the author of The Longest Day. However, although Ryan had the support of Donovan's friends, President Dwight D. Eisenhower and Alan W. Dulles, then director of Central Intelligence, the work was stopped before it really began. A middle-rank official at the CIA managed to stop the project because he believed the book contemplated by Ryan would be too controversial. When he found himself denied access to the director's files, Ryan was compelled to abandon the project temporarily. Then, he too died before it was possible to resume work. In all these attempts, none of the authors saw the microfilm except Reed, who saw two or three reels having to do with the OSS's formation. During this time, Putzel had been taken so seriously ill that he burned his copy of microfilm rather than leave it unguarded in his estate should he die. Happily, Putzel did not die. Nonetheless, the only copy of the microfilm outside the CIA, where in 1982 it was still classified, was Donovan's. Four different authors tried to write this history, and then it says death intervened. I love that, as though death was some deus ex machina being lowered onto the classical stage. I am death. I will now intervene. You bet it intervened. It intervened like all hell here. And I think as we look at what is taking place today, and the genesis of the Habsburg Western intelligence, anti-Soviet and then anti-Russian alliance operating in a Christian West concept of the Max von Hohenlohe negotiations out of Wittgenstein with Dulles, with Stuart Menzies, Donovan et al. I think we can see just what was so controversial and why Beth had to intervene with all four authors here. Anyway, some perspective on what is happening today. This concludes, for the record, 1009, The Deep Politics of Habsburg Redux and the Russiagate PSYOP. This is being recorded on May 29th of 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.